Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Today, it's nothing less than the story of Australia's biggest business collapse. A collapse so big that it dwarfs its nearest rivals. It happened just 20 years ago, and so few of us have heard of it, let alone remember what happened and why. It's a story of big, raw-boned Australian men with coppers haircuts and baggy suits who exercised power ruthlessly on the national stage and yet managed to stay out of view. They exercised that power sometimes narrowly and greedily, and in the end, they lost it all, and we all live with the consequences of that today. Australia's wool business fell, and it fell hard, in 1991. Today, it's only a third of the size that it once was. It's a great yarn, and Charles Massey is here to tell it. Charles Massey is a man with long involvement in the wool industry and with sheep breeding, and he's conducted a kind of one-man royal commission into the collapse of what was our biggest export industry. His book is called Breaking the Sheep's Back, the shocking true story of the decline and fall of the Australian wool industry. Hello, Charles.
Hello, Richard, and great to be here. Thank you.
You're a man of the land yourself. Did you grow up on the land?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Whereabouts?
In the Snowy Mountains area on the high plateau near Cooma, south of Canberra.
You lost your mum at a young age, Charles.
Yes, I was about four and a half, and my mother died suddenly. It was actually a suicide. I think in those days, what they used to call manic depressive or bipolar, they didn't know much about it. And that was the result.
How did you cope without your mum around as a kid?
Well, you know, kids are pretty resilient at that age, and people say, tough and all the rest. But look, my father remarried not long after, and I had a caring stepmother. My father was great, and some of the memories are repressed from that time, but look, resilient children, so really, it's no crutch I look back on at all.
I suppose you've got the natural world all around you to get lost in, haven't you, in those days?
Well, that's true. I was an only child, so you learn to be self-sufficient, and I spent a lot of time on my own chasing rabbits and going up the bush, and it was, you know, a fabulous upbringing, really.
You went to King's School. Was Alan Jones one of your teachers?
Yes, he was.
What do you remember of him at that time?
Well, to be fair, he taught me English and tennis and football, and in all my years of schooling, he's the best educator I ever had. I didn't run across, if you read the biographies on him by Chris Masters and others, I didn't run across any of the negatives, and he's certainly different then to what he's become. So I'll be fair to the bloke. He's a wonderful educator.
Once you had an education, were you expected to return to the land?
Yes. Look, my father was aged about 47 when I was born, so he was almost two generations older. And a lot of implicit pressure. And so I came home for a couple of years and found it a bit difficult.
Yeah, farmers often say it's hard to work for your dad.
Yes, it's fraught. It's a fraught relationship. And
can dads be a bit, let me do it, give it to me? Can they be a bit like that?
They can be like that, but, you know, the other side of the coin, every young son thinks he knows it all. And so ne'er the twain shall meet in that phase. Yeah, so I wanted to, eventually I realised I wanted to do further education. And so we had a couple of good barneys over that, but eventually I took off to university for a while.
How did going to uni broaden your view of the land?
It broadened my mind, Richard, in that I wanted to do zoology because I'd had a terrific teacher early in life who got me into bird watching and things. I wanted to join, CSIRO wildlife research. Ended up with a strict Oxford professor who got me measuring rats licking water or something a long way from studying animals in the wild. So luckily I came across a fabulous course which taught holistic thinking called Human Ecology. And interestingly, my tutor then is now my current supervisor. I'm doing a PhD back at ANU. And that was really a breakthrough because I realised I was more an holistic thinker than a sort of narrow discipline reductionist thinker. So I guess I brought that when I came back to the bush to try and explore all avenues of an issue rather than just a narrow one.
How did that go when you started telling people about these newfangled ideas you'd got from the university about taking a holistic approach to nature?
Well, it's pretty soon after I ended up going home, I wanted to try and breed my own sheep and started a merino stud. And naturally, being trained biologist, we, with some help, and I work with ex-CSIRO scientists, tried to apply biology and molecular genetics. Well, as you probably know, she's a bit of a conservative industry, the old merino industry, and so it was, to put it politely, looked at askance. But what was interesting, the other side of the coin, and it's part of what's behind this story, Australian taxpayers have been paying money in for promotion and research, and a particular scientific paradigm had developed that had sequestered nearly all the funds, and it was purely based on measurement, and there's no sort of holistic biology or anything about it.
So all the research funds were all about, never mind the quality field, the width, in other words, so to speak.
Yeah, in a way, this particular group were focused on basically producing more of wool, et cetera, and weren't looking at the customer, and they pretty much dominated all the positions in the field, and they resented, I found this subsequently as I went along, they resented anyone breeding sheep a bit differently, and I was working with scientists who'd been eased out, who were on the outer as well. So, without getting into it.
Why would they want to ease out scientists who want to improve the quality of our wool?
Well, if you understand the history of science, it's a classic way it functions. You have an entrenched body of belief called a paradigm. So you build up the professorships and you get people in the right funding positions and you control the editing of the journals. People genuinely come to believe that pathway is correct. But it's ever the history of science that it needs a challenging view of the world. Like, Galileo or someone, he was, almost put to the stake for a different belief. And that's ever been thus in science. It's an ongoing, rolling series of revolutions of established views.
I'll come back to that in just a moment. You took up mountaineering for a while. And how far did you go with that, Charles?
Yes, that ANU had some... A lot of international visitors in used to mountaineering and serious stuff, and we had a good mountaineering club. So I got seriously into rock climbing and climbing in New Zealand. And then our club formed the... We mounted the first... to use a bad pun, sorry. We organised the first Himalayan expedition from Australia. And so I went to Himalayas. And there's a group of fellows I climbed with, some of whom, like Tim McCartney-Snape and Lincoln Hall, who you might remember nearly died on Everest a few years ago.
He's been a guest on this very program.
There you go.
Talking about that very thing.
Yep. Well, I climbed with them. Once spent 4 days with Lincoln hanging off hammocks on Rock Face, Mount Buffalo. And so I ended up going to them before they did their first Everest climb. We went to the Chinese Tibetan Plateau. But I realised pretty quickly I had a family by then and I wasn't at their level mentally or anything, and so I never continued. They're world class and I was, tagging along.
You mentioned your family then. Tell me, it was through that kind of pastime that you met your wife Fiona. Tell me how you met her, because it's a lovely story.
Yes, it is. It's quite romantic, Richard. Her younger brother was a good mate of mine. And I suppose I met Fiona when I was 16, 17, and you know what that's like, a pimply adolescent mate. Don't want to know you. So we didn't sort of take any account of each other for 6, 7 years. But in preparation for the Himalayan climb, right in the middle of the Snowy Mountains, there's a glacial lake called Blue Lake, and you can get some excellent ice climbing in the middle of winter. So 4 of us skied in there to have a weekend, training for the Himalayas. And this massive blizzard came in And so we, instead of spending a weekend in an ice cave being bloody uncomfortable, we said, well, you know, let's get out of here. So we skied out. It was after dark, but we were experienced. We had torches, head torches. And not far from getting back to the ski resort called Gathaka, it was really severe blizzard. So we hunkered down to have a rest. And we heard this voice in a break in the wind.
What kind of voice?
Well, it was a cry, cry for help. And anyway, cut a long story short, we found this bloke who had almost committed every cardinal sin. He'd left from Sydney that day, never been to the mountains, didn't tell anyone where he was going, had the wrong clothing, didn't know where he was going, had the wrong gear. And I reckon he probably had 2 hours to live with. He was going down with hypothermia. So we dragged him back to the nearest ski lodge, between four of us, dragged him into the drying room to thaw out because his mind was already going, as you do with deep hypothermia. And around the corner of the drying room came this stunning young woman who was my future wife, and it was instant.
It literally broke the ice. Literally broke the ice between you.
It did, and whatever it is, you know, that Cupid's arrow across the space, all that sort of stuff, but it's the best thing that ever happened to me.
It happens to us guys, that thing, it does. You were talking about that you made a decision to begin a merino stud, and tell me about the kind of sheep you were producing and the merino sheep and why it was so radical for its time.
Yeah, well, it was based, believe it or not, without going into the biology and stuff, but it's based on logical genetic work that wool comes, like our hair or a dog's hair, it comes from follicles in the skin, and you can organise them through genetics to grow a better fibre, which is protein. But this work was counter to, as I said before, some of the ruling approaches and the team that was doing it. And it was part of this story because the Wool Corporation, who was then funding it, were backing another approach, which I call a sort of mediocrity socialist type approach. So these scientists were eased out, and I started to work with them. And we started to breed a wonderful silky fibre, which the customer was demanding, but which the Australian statutory bodies weren't fostering. And the big spin-off, and it was realised early by the innovator of this, ex-CSRO person called Dr. Jim Watts, that if you bred down this track, you could get rid of the wrinkle and stop the sheep mulesing, which, as you know, is a major controversy.
Yeah, it is. It's probably worth talking about that because that was a huge international controversy. But for people who aren't familiar with the story, please explain the story behind the mulesing controversy.
Right. Well, the merino sheep traditionally is wrinkly, and that attracts blowflies, which then wreak havoc. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars, pain, suffering, lots of chemical to go on. And here was an elegant solution, you know, the forerunner of which had been known since the 1930s by previous CSIRO scientists. And so, led by this innovator, Jim Watts, we stopped mulesing our sheep 10 years ago. Now, mulesing is the process where, and it seems brutal, and it is, using shears, no anaesthetic, you cut off the wrinkles.
The back end of the sheep.
At the back end of the sheep.
Yes.
And create scar tissue so the flies don't land there anymore. Now, we were able to eliminate the wrinkle just through good genetics and get rid of mulesing, you know, way in advance of this global controversy.
Great, because, you know, animal rights campaigners objected to this process of mulesing and wool growers came under attack from animal rights groups as a result. Now, we've sort of covered this in this program a couple of years ago as well. But here was a breed of sheep that didn't require mulesing. Great, problem solved, surely. You would have thought, Charles, wouldn't it?
Yes, you would have, Richard, and that's a good question. But you then step into the minefield of wool politics, and the controversy rages today. The world's leading retailers say, please stop this cruel animal practice. But the successors to this debacle, because politics was never cleaned out, so the current board, called Australian Wool Innovation, all the hierarchy through science, right from government, federal and state ministers, down departments, even the RSPCA, they still support the establishment wool body in sticking up for mulesing and trying to doctor it with a few other pain relief things.
What does this say about them? Because it's really a mindset you're talking about here, a mindset from these wool boards that they have towards their customers.
Yeah, that's a critical issue, and it's critical in this story. And look, it goes back to the 20s and 30s, because half the wool growers in Australia grow wheat as well, on mixed farms. And they always had this view, and they got really cruel in the Depression years because the federal government then encouraged them to grow more wheat under the Scullin government to try and earn foreign revenue for Australia. But when the Depression hit, the government refused to pay subsidies. And these, a lot of the soldier settlers were, you know, it's a horrific story, the soldier settlement. And from that came this attitude that the middleman in the supply chain, whether it be in wheat or wool, was always there ripping us off. And perversely, they became the enemy. And when this story starts to unfold in the 80s, the agricultural politicians, who are largely culpable, they had this extraordinary attitude that the customer had become the enemy. And to answer your question, that attitude is still pervasive today. And otherwise, why wouldn't you respond to the customer's request to get rid of mulesing?
What made you want to write this one-man Royal Commission, as you call it?
Well, look, two reasons. Over the years, I mean, it's probably clear, I was getting frustrated with some of the roadblocks in this industry. So I started to encounter things when I was breeding to do with science and administration. I knew we could breed a better fibre, so I got involved in international marketing with some of the world's leading processors in Italy and elsewhere. Did some exporting on my own account, even we had to fight the statutory bodies to do that at the end of the scheme. And so I started to, and I then started to hear from those customers some of the horrific stuff had been going on, how they'd been treated badly. In about 2 years after the collapse we're talking about, which I know you'll get to, there was yet another ongoing collapse in the industry, and the inevitable thing happens. You have another report. This time it was Roscano's report. And out of that, Simon Crean, the then minister, appointed me to the statutory wool boards. And I was the first wool grower since their inception in the 30s that hadn't come out of politics.
So what did he tell you? What did Simon Crean charge you with when he put you on that bull board?
Well, people in his office department, basically I was instructed to be a change agent.
Go in there and stir up change.
Yeah, which I did constructively with board papers. But I had targets on my back because I'd come not out of politics. And so I learnt a lot about administration of, you know, we had a $50, $70 million research fund and equivalent in promotion. And I tried, I led a review of the research because I had a science training. And so we adopted world best practice. So the heads of BHP, CRA, portfolios and research and ICI, they... So we tried to instigate a policy that didn't go down well.
Why would that be met with resistance, bringing world's best practice into research to open up new markets, create better fibres? Why would that be met with such hostility, as you say?
Combination of factors, I think, Richard. Australia was the biggest wool-growing industry in the world. So, you know, we were the queen bee in many respects. So if we sneeze, everyone else caught the flu.
So we've been like OPEC. In other words, are we a bit like that? We're a bit like Saudi Arabia in OPEC. Are we
in a way,
the big number one? We can sort of dictate the market. We can say how it all works. Is that what you're saying?
That's what came. So we were complacent because we'd been so successful. We had the best, as everyone said. And so far, this is by the early 90s, we'd got away without necessarily having to listen to our customers too well. We just produced it and there it was.
Cop that, world.
Well, pretty much. So when we tried to say, well, look, you know, how about let's get vastly more professional, because the current system was shot through with nepotism. People didn't look around the world for the best suppliers of research. It just went to our established bodies. And so, look, at the end of all that, I went out the revolving door off the boards. I only lasted the mandatory 2 years. By then, the agricultural politicians were doing the appointing. And I said, you know, I went home and said, God, thank heavens for all that. And then I was rung by the editor of Australian Farm Journal, which is probably a leading professional journal. And naively, he said, would you like to do 5 articles about your concerns for the industry and some solutions? And more naively, I said, yeah, sure.
What happened when they were published?
Well, after the second one, all hell broke loose, and I found myself under injunction, a really nasty injunction with the statutory bodies using QCs. I was getting late-night phone calls from managing directors in the statutory bodies saying, you know, back off or you'll lose the farm, and and the minister's office was ringing. So, but I was, at the time, I was exporting with the world's biggest buyer of wool, a giant company called Itochu. And my information that had led to this injunction was rock solid. And I think we changed a couple of words in one article, and they had to pulp 30,000 copies of the journal. But they wanted to shut us down, and the editor backed me, and we proceeded, luckily. So the articles came out. And so I went back on the farm, got on with my breeding, and I said, what the hell was all that about? And when I thought about it, I realised there's something subterranean here. There's a lot of power. It's hidden. There's something repressed. Goes right to the top. And I started digging.
Okay. My guest in conversation is Charles Massey, a man who's had a long involvement in the wool industry, and he's written the story of the biggest business industry collapse in Australian history, the collapse of the wool industry, and it was a long time in coming. And when it fell in 1991, oh dear, how it fell. Let's hear this story now, because it's a story really of a breakup of a club, really. And the 80s and 90s are full of stories of the breakup of great Australian clubs. You have to start with three men, don't we? The three big men, Victorian, New South Welshman, and a Queenslander. Black Jack McEwen, John Crawford, and Sir William Gunn. The interesting thing I get from your book, reading the stories of these men, one was a deputy prime minister, one was his departmental secretary, the other one was head of the wool board. They're all maybe scarred by the experience of the 1920s and the depression of the 1930s. They'd seen that soldier settler scheme go horribly wrong. Terrible poverty, people ruined, suicide, people walking off the land, starvation, all those kinds of things. Is that the thing that kind of motivated them into want to setting up what was essentially a kind of a great socialist conglomeration?
Yeah, that's a really perceptive analysis, Richard. I mean, this is a very much a human story. We're not talking about evil chonks. We're talking about very much human people caught up in circumstances. And McEwen was a soldier settler. You know, I remember one story in his biography. He went and helped a neighbour bury his six-year-old daughter at midnight in the graveyard because he couldn't afford the funeral. You know, so there's no way you can come through those experiences without being deeply scarred. And his departmental head, Sir John Crawford, I think you were at ANU, as I am, and we know what a well-recognised and fine public servant he was. But his experiences and his training in America, and he was working in banks in rural areas in the Depression, also forced him, like McEwen, to say, well, look, government has a role here to play in interfering in markets and stabilising it. And then there's old Bill Gunn. A Queensland.
Describe him physically. It's worth describing him physically because the pictures of him are extraordinary.
How long have you got, Richard? He, without doubt, he has to be the larger-than-life character of any politician that's walked the Australian stage. He was 6'5", 2 metres in the new scale. He'd be 120 kilos, sort of 18 stone. Had a crew cut almost like an echidna, a spiky hairdo with a part down the middle.
Right down the middle.
He didn't respect clothes in that he just didn't worry about them. So the best Italian or English tailors would put a suit on him and within minutes it'd be like a potato sack, it'd be wrecked. He'd go onto international platforms with a tie askew, odd socks, his fly half down. and his behaviour was equivalent. He was a big bulldozing, self-confidence, larger-than-life character and he's probably the key player in ramming through the flawed policies that followed.
I love the stories about him going to meet French couturiers in Paris and drinking bowls of soup with both hands there with his falling out of his clothes. But it seems like he played the hick a little bit. This is a nice trick that country politicians in many countries do. They play the hick so people underestimate them and underestimate their intelligence and guile. Mm.
That's right. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people and ex-ABC journalist Sally Lone helped me enormously. She was doing a biography of him. Yeah, look, he'd in front of the European aristocracy of the textile world, he'd stir his coffee with his glasses and deliberately almost deceive them into thinking that he was a dumb hick. But underneath, he was a Machiavellian, shrewd judge of human character, and he could woo a wool grower with wonderful oratory, even if it was a load of bulldust. That sounded convincing.
So between these three men, They're really the three men responsible for the building of Fortress Australia, as it was then. Building McEwen certainly built a high tariff wall, high protection for industries, which allowed manufacturers to stay in business and not be subject to international competition. And Bill Gunn did the same thing for the wool industry, effectively, and worked as hard as he could to do that. And that meant Australia could be, I suppose, stable and reasonably prosperous for a time, but in the end it was always going to come a cropper.
That's true. I mean, I think everyone, you read the biographies of McEwen, he was a patriot. He believed he was doing the right thing. What they didn't realise was when it was time to change policy. And protectionism continued on too long. And agricultural protectionism, subsidies, and the sort of scheme you know we're talking about here was part of the problem. And as we can discuss, the sort of scheme they set up for wool had a 100% failure rate throughout the 20th century in every other commodity. So, you know, why try and defy gravity here?
The story of the trying to set up a reserve price for wool starts with this fantastic little fact you've uncovered from 1950, I think it is, the start of the Korean War. Black Jack McEwen's there in the cabinet of Sir Robert Menzies, and he's got John Crawford working with him. And the US government made a secret approach to the Australian government at the time. Tell me about uncovering this fact, please, Charles.
Yeah, well, it was in the Australian archives, and I had access to some of the new cabinet papers, secret papers. The background of that is that in the First and Second World War, I suppose it's understandable, but we acted like in colonial servitude. We just let England compulsorily acquire all our key commodities. They regarded them as strategic war commodities, and our wool clip was one of them.
Well, to make uniforms, essentially.
Yeah. Essentially, yeah. It was what was called a khaki trade in the war. But, you know, England didn't get where it's got by sitting on its laurels. So its manufacturers made massive profits because the price was pegged, and at the end of the war, Australian wool growers weren't receiving the cost of production because of bad negotiation by our government. But at the same time, England blocked out any competitors, and America had the biggest wool textile industry emerging at the time, so it's pretty handy they could use that lever. And then, not learning from all that mistake, Menzies and the previous Prime Minister, Stanley Melbourne Bruce, who was as Anglophile as they come, they said to England, here you are, have another clip, which they proceeded to make hay with. So when the Korean War emerged, America, who was come out of the war not debilitated like Europe, cashed up, and they made a secret approach in August 1950 at prime ministerial level to acquire Australia's wool clip.
Well, the entirety of it.
Entirety.
The entirety of the year's wool production.
Yes, and with a view to allocating amongst allies, but it was they wanted to be the controller. Now, the Menzies government, Menzies down, because we know he was an Anglophile, McEwen, Crawford, the cabinet said, no, we're going to go with Mother England. And
In fact, didn't Crawford say, you've got him in this book saying, we don't want to be in the business of dressing US soldiers like officers.
Yes, that's right. There was...
What was that about?
Well, I mean, it's exactly. It stands out in the cabinet paper. So obviously there was a prejudice against the Yankees from across the ocean for some reason in favour of Mother England. To run such a scheme, they had to have a reserve price scheme, which is really the basis to this story. Now, a reserve price scheme is what's been known in economic history as a buffer stock scheme. So it's where a government or its authorities believes that they can manipulate the market. And they do that. They set a trigger level at a low price. If the price drops below that in the market, they buy up with a view to selling into the market. And as we discussed before, throughout the 20th century, rubber, tin, cocoa, you name it, every scheme had failed. And so the...
You know, I'm on this bit of Roman history bent at the moment. The Emperor Diocletian tried to fix prices and it blew up in his face completely. It was one of his biggest disasters. Every scheme that's been instituted that I'm aware of to fix price for a commodity, a valuable commodity, has failed and blown right in the face of the person who's tried to set that price. But we thought we could get it right this time, did we?
We did. And the tragedy was that... When the Australian government said, you know, basically pee off America, they then held a referendum. The wool growers had to agree to have such a scheme. And the wool growers said no, overwhelmingly. There's a massive...
Why did they say no?
There was a massive national referendum, 100,000 wool growers. I think communism, they just had an election, federal election, which over socialisation of banks, and the bogey under the communist bogey under the bed was sort of beaten, and so the wool growers, independent lot, were wary of government intervention. But the tragedy was America was then insulted. It said, well, we're going to get the wool, and that's what led to the Korean War boom. And two key things came out of that. After every boom, there's a massive bust. And I interviewed our leading processors around the world, and when it broke, the devastation of capital and customers was enormous.
This is in the early 50s.
Early
50s.
Yeah. But secondly, it coincided with the rise of the big synthetics, the new polyesters, you know, the giant transnational petrochemical companies. And there is the conundrum for Australia with McEwen and Gunn and everyone starting to push for protection. So the Australian industry really, the wool industry, had this choice, clear choice. Mimic what you'd done for eight centuries, which had led to the greatest secondary industry in Europe, to the Industrial Revolution, which is improve your fibre, look after your customers, get more competitive, or take a political path. They chose the latter, and they tried to defy gravity with getting a scheme that we knew would fail, and there we go. That's the rest of the story.
So Black Jack McEwen at this point now becomes Deputy Prime Minister of Australia and an enormously powerful figure.
Yeah,
he's come from that horrible background of dreadful rural poverty in Victoria, and now he's come all the way up, and he's Bill Gunn's best friend. And he says, go on, I want you to go out there and propose a reserve price scheme. Now, let me get this right. If I understand how this scheme was to work, that the idea is that you set a floor price for wool. And that's nominated by the statutory body, the wool board of its state. They say this is the minimum price we're going to accept for wool. And if the market doesn't want to pay that price, then the wool will be bought by that statutory body, by the government, by the wool board itself.
Correct. And what's intriguing, because I had another, as things got worse, because once the synthetics start to undercut the market, the price dropped, costs rose because of McEwen's protectionist policies. And so inevitably you get that combination of factors. You get agitation amongst the wool-growing constituency. So we have another government report. And so it was playing into Bill Gunn's hands. So they had another go at pushing in a reserve price in 1965.
And they failed again.
Another referendum. And what's really intriguing, going to the cabinet documents, some of Australia's finest economic and financial brains, heads of Treasury in the 50s, Sir Roland Wilson, in the 60s, Sir Richard Randall, their prediction of the danger of this scheme is almost word perfect to what happened. It's extraordinary.
So the scheme would be that they set the floor price. If the market's not prepared to pay it, they stockpile it. Who pays for the wool then if it's being stockpiled? Who's actually buying this wool that can't be sold on the open market?
Well, at this time, it was going to be largely the government, but the wool taxpayers had to pay compulsory taxes.
Who are the wool taxpayers?
Anyone growing wool, you are compulsorily taxed as soon as you sell it, and the tax is on your gross income, nothing to do with after expenses or anything. It's right up front. And at the end of this debacle, all of us wool growers were paying up to 25% of our income gross.
In wool tax. So these taxes are being levied from wool growers. A giant pool of money is created to buy wool when the price goes south, essentially.
Correct.
And you stockpile it and wait for the price to go up again, and then you can sell it again. That's the scheme.
That's right, in a nutshell. Yep.
Now, in theory, it could work, couldn't it? It could stabilise prices from year to year. In theory, it's not a bad idea when you think about it, because it would stabilise the price and do all sorts of good things. When the economists, when the pointy-headed economic rationalist purists that everyone hated so much objected to this floor price scheme, this reserve price scheme, what did they predict would actually happen?
Well, as you rightly point out, there's theory and then human nature steps in.
Yes.
Practice and human nature. And eventually the circumstances will emerge when, particularly in a wool boom, when greed gets the better of us and we set a price above the market, and then if you chuck into that this belief that the customer can pay, this antipathy to the customer, when there's a refusal to lower the price with adjusting to the market, then suddenly, and this is what happened, everyone likes to pretend that the 80s, the decade of Grieg and the corporate cowboys, Bondi and everyone, that was them. But here's this conservative, careful wool industry. It wouldn't get caught up in the 80s euphoria. But it did. And when the commodities were booming in the late 80s, in 1988, they set a floor price that was below the then market, but way above long term. And when things started to turn sour, if you then chuck in the agri-political antipathy to the customer, they said, no, they can afford to pay it. And they refused to come off with the price.
So during the reserve price was scheme was put in place in the 70s under the Whitlam government, and the price in the mid-80s shot right up.
Correct.
To insanely high levels. But when it was time to drop the price, they wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't they do it? Couldn't they see what was coming?
Well, yeah, look, I hesitate because it's a complex human story. I think what ended up happening was that since the 20s and 30s, a group of agricultural politicians, a reserve price was the holy grail. They'd fought for it decade after decade, and it was going to solve all their problems. These nasty customers would be at last forced to pay instead of making mega profits. And when the downturn came in the late 80s, when all the commodities collapsed, it was incredibly rapid. And if you chuck into that this attitude to the customer, there was just this deep recalcitrance. And then, and it's a well-known effect in social psychology called groupthink. An author called Janus studied the Vietnam War and the Bay of Pigs and those sorts of things, and studied cabinet documents to see why a group of leaders, when things go wrong, basically circle the wagons of the lager or dig the trenches. And there's a whole lot of factors come into it. And I analysed this story through that lens, and it was 100% groupthink. They started to defend a bad decision rather than do what was right for the industry.
Because that bad decision had made them so incredibly rich, hadn't it? Many of those men. I mean, the wool price had gone right up and up and up and up and up, and they were making spectacular profits for a couple of years there in the 80s. Spectacular, like never before, unheard of profits.
That's right. That was a booming market, nothing to do with the price, the floor price, because they were hardly buying any wool then, the statutory authority. Where the danger occurred was when the market dropped. And
they wouldn't drop.
Exactly. And so customers very quickly began to vote with their feet. If they couldn't get wool, they switched to other fibres, substituted, and some of them just withdrew their capital. And the authorities, the Australian Wool Corporation and these wool growers, said no, they can afford to pay, not realising the market was going way below the level they'd set.
You spoke to Paul Keating in the course of making this book, Charles, and he was Treasurer, of course, for much of this time, and then eventually Prime Minister. What did he say about this period where prices went up and up and the floor price wouldn't go down? Sorry, well, the floor price went up and up and wouldn't go down again. What did Paul Keating, what was his view on this?
Well, he thought the whole scheme was stupid ever since he became Treasurer. But he had to work with consensus, and it wasn't causing a blip on the radar until 1989, so... they condoned what was going on. The tragedy here is that when things started to go wrong in the late 1989, it happened very rapidly, like in the blink of an eye. The Wool Corporation, in buying wool, blew $2 billion in 2 months, then had to borrow another two in another 2 months, and suddenly most wool growers, weren't aware what was going on. It happened that rapidly, and it coincided with the federal election of early 1990. And the federal minister, John Kerin, his advisor, said, don't even think of touching this wounded snake, the wool industry, because it'll bite us. So when they should have acted, they left it. And that everyone was caught up in the election. And then straight after that, we then come into the tussle between...
The Hawke-Keating leadership battle.
Hawke-Keating, yeah, and the Kirribilli Agreement. Which
so no one was paying attention then?
No, they were distracted with these other issues, politics, and at the very moment that the issue should have been addressed. And Keating told me, and I've had it verified by people in his office, etc., that for Hawke to be able to renege on the Kirribilli Agreement, he needed a few allies in cabinet, and a few people retired after the election or lost their position. But there was two key portfolios that Hawke needed. One was Beazley's portfolio on communication, so they watered down that policy, and the other one was Kerin with wool. And according to Keating and some of his advisors, the wool debacle was allowed to carry on and more billions borrowed.
Because Bob Hawke wanted to give John Kerin his head on this so he could keep him on side.
That's pretty much right.
Keating's alleged to this.
Yeah, Keating's summary was wool was the sacrificial lamb for the prime ministership.
How did it all come unstuck?
It came unstuck because Australia's very economy now came under threat. You had massive international borrowings. Not only had they blown billions, but they now started to borrow. Eventually, it was over $3 billion.
To stockpile wool. Were there sheds anywhere near big enough to actually hold all this wool that they were withholding from the market? I wonder, you know.
Well, they weren't. There's 200 sheds all around the world. I calculated, I mean, a bale of wool is about two household refrigerators. If you stacked the stockpile at the end, it was nearly 5 billion bales, 4.8 nearly. If you stacked it end to end, it would go from Sydney to Perth and halfway back. So it was a fair little stockpile.
We could cover the whole surface of Australia with a woolly carpet, in other words.
Exactly right.
With what was stockpiled.
Exactly right. And this debacle, as it unwound now, started to threaten the very fabric of the economy. Balance of payments, it was the withdrawal of export revenue as much as the borrowings too. And at the same time, you had a Tricontinental Bank and other major merchant banks falling over and... the federal
State
government.
Bank of Victoria, yep. All of those things.
All that. So the timing was horrendous, but you then had the Australian Wool Corporation and these agri-politicians on their, they were non-elected on their council called Wool Council, digging deeper in the trench. They weren't going to condone, and the minister was caught in the middle. He was trying to get them to see reason, but they wouldn't.
At the bottom of all this chain is, are the wool growers themselves, and they're making no money, are they? Or are they? I don't know. Were they rising up? How were they viewing how this body was behaving on their behalf, the Wool Board?
Most of them didn't know. I mean, you're stuck out in the bush. I've been there. You're too busy trying to survive and fight blowflies and make a quid and maybe a drought. And their representatives weren't telling them the truth. And the thing was, no one knew where the market was. All they knew was that these authorities were buying. The only time we found out where the market really was when it all fell over and the market halved overnight.
And what happened then? What did wool growers then have to do once the market fell over?
Well, they went into really hard times. Essentially what happened, and I'm intrigued watching the recent American debacle, you've got Standard and Poor's in there advising America, bearing in mind that they'd been part of the credit prime problem. But they were advising the Wool Corporation, you've got to drop the floor price or you won't keep your credit rating, because the corporation was some of the big borrowers internationally then. They were going to the world's big banks. Primary Industry Minister Kerrin said, enough's enough. You won't get the borrowings. The government can't lend you. Treasury was sort of having heart attacks, and they pulled the rug, and it halved overnight. The price collapsed. But the big cost, and this is where we can get to how big the cost is, but the big cost, other than what growers had funded, is that our international customers overnight, they'd been, if you like, blackmailed into buying wool at a very high price. When it halved, went from 870 to 430 cents, more than a half, they were stranded with high-priced stocks and their competitors could now start undercutting them. And their write-down of capital was in the billions. And a lot of
in a global recession.
Yes, and in a global recession. And a lot of them never came back to wool. A lot of them had already substituted. And that was a permanent write-down. And I've been to Italy and all sorts of places.
So you're saying the wool industry destroyed our customers?
Absolutely.
Many of our customers.
Yep, and that's never been fully acknowledged and even denied. And many a time I've walked into an international mill and met anger, even in the last few years, because family companies in, say, Italy or somewhere, did $8 to $14 million overnight, if you can imagine a family company, because of political stupidity back in this country.
What happened to that vast store of wool we'd been buying from our own growers? The one that was going to Perth and halfway back again. What happened to all that? Where did that go?
Well, it took 10 years to sell, and a lot of it was inferior.
10 years?
10 years, and a lot of it was inferior. And we had to pay for the administration. We were immediately after the collapse, wool growers were paying 15% upfront gross to pay for the debacle. So the wool growers were being blamed. They tried to persuade us to shoot 50 million sheep at one stage because suddenly it was our fault. The 10 years overhang depressed the market. A lot of it was the wool we shouldn't have grown because there were false market signals. But, Richard, I've done a recent calculation of the overnight impact of this collapse in 1991. And we're talking in 91 terms, $12 billion. And if you recalculate today using the proper inflation figures from the RBA, et cetera, we're talking over $20 billion. Now, none of the corporate cowboys come anywhere near that.
Yeah, Bond was like 3.5, wasn't he, I think?
Yeah, exactly. Adelaide Steamship, maybe 7, but HIH, 4.5. So why on earth hasn't this story been exposed before? Why wasn't there a Royal Commission? Because the government's fingerprints were all over this, back through 7 cabinets.
Many governments' fingerprints.
Yeah.
Well, there's your answer, isn't it?
I guess in a nutshell, yes.
Well, so now we have an industry a third of the size it used to be, and the crippling of what was a major money earner for this country as an export commodity, and a really high-quality one as well. What have been some of the cascading effects of that, aside from the lost export earnings there to the country, Charles?
Yeah, look, that's an important question, which I've tried to address at the end of the book, because it's no good just kicking heads and telling a bad story. I think we have to learn from this. I mean, it's a bit like someone with a brain tumour keeps taking aspirin without trying to diagnose what's causing the headache. What happened in the Wool Corporation era wasn't just this debacle on a mismanaged reserve price scheme. It tried to become, if you like, a giant monopolistic DuPont, a big chemical company. So it chose a wrong business model. So all the individuality, the people like us who are trying to breed a better fibre or a non-mulesing sheep, we were crunched. There was no room for that individual innovation. You had to produce a bulk commodity so this giant corporation could trade with the big boys.
Yeah, I think you make the analogy with the wine industry there, don't you? I mean, it would be like if there was one body representing the whole of the Australian wine industry, which insisted we had to put wine in generic, clean skin bottles and just call it Australian wine.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Henschke and all the boys, you know, we don't need your labels. Let's just call it Australian wine. I mean, that's a bit simple. But in effect, that's what happened. But that attitude to one industry, to a commodity rather than the, you know, what we can do in the breeding with wool is like what, if you look at our competitors, the big boys, the DuPonts, the ICIs, they invest billions year after year in improving a fibre. We never even considered that as a pathway. And if we had of, we could have this diversity of like a New Zealand icebreaker brand, we could have 15 of them, $20 billion export. But we've chosen this, if you like, this quasi-socialistic mediocrity path, and those systems are still in place. We still have statutory bodies because when it fell over, tragically, instead of cleaning out the rat's nest of intervention and politics, it's been exacerbated with more and more reports, more and more bodies. We have politicised elections and we have bodies with vested interests sitting on boards. I tear my hair out, but, you know, and I've challenged the minister.
So if you're the one-man Royal Commission, what are you, the Royal Commissioner, calling for? What are your top three recommendations here coming out of this one-man Royal Commission you've done into our wool industry, Charles?
Well, Richard, I had a piece in the Weekend Australian last week, and in the last paragraph I'm challenging the minister directly, Joe Ludwig. In lieu of what should have been a Royal Commission back in the early 90s, here it is, chapter and verse. Statutory intervention is crueling us. It has crueled us. Clean it out.
Abolish it.
Yep. Abolish the compulsory taxes. Then you get rid of the politics, what the economists call the rent seekers, the parasites. They've got no reason to exist. They've got no one to represent. We can then get on with normal commercial behaviour and develop our marketing ourselves, etc. So that's the key thing. And with that goes lots of systems that are hangover from the Wool Corporation that we've never examined.
So can the minister do that? I mean, his connections, you know, he's a Labor minister, his connections to the, you know, he doesn't owe anyone the National Party any favours or the National Farmers Federation too many favours, I would have thought. So could the minister do that without too much political trouble, do you think, Charles?
Richard, I think it comes down to what the Spanish call cajones, whether he's
cajones.
Got, whether he's got a certain degree of fortitude to take the action. And I'm not sure. But anyway, the challenge is there, and it would be good governance, it would be prescient leadership for them now to address this.
The agri-politicians aside, what are fellow wool growers telling you about your book, Charles?
The emails are coming in now, it's released, and I'm just astounded. You know, we had to shoot 1,000 sheep. It's the worst day of my life. We went broke. I've had friends have lost farms, suicides, family, marriage breakdowns. I had a call in Melbourne yesterday from a person with the Independent Agents Association. They went broke overnight because they'd invested in wool futures, and when the rug was pulled, That led to suicides. It led to jailing, you know, for bad decisions. The heartfelt stories, the length and breadth of Australia, are really part of the story. I've been driven to write this story.
And the upside of this is, if what you say is right, that there's huge export dollars to be grabbed again, isn't there? I mean, there's huge, another major, to restore wool to becoming the commodity that perhaps it once was, or something like it once was.
There is, and what's exciting about it is that we're on the cusp of changing into a whole sustainable innovation cycle in world business, the greening of the world, which we've got to get into. We've got a natural fibre here that isn't made from petrochemicals. We're starting to learn, because I'm doing a PhD in sustainable agriculture and innovation back at ANU, and what I'm learning there is unbelievably exciting about how we can regenerate our landscapes for healthier food, fixing carbon and growing clean fibre and healthy meat, etc. So it all dovetails in. If we got it right and we had some leadership, I'm very optimistic.
Great to have you in today, Charles, to tell this story, which I have to shamefully admit I was completely unaware of until I read your book. Thank you so much for being my guest.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.